Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. A lot of people.
We missed you.
Well, nice to be here. We've been on winter retreat in the Theravada tradition. All our monastic calendar has in it what we call the rains retreat, which is corresponds to the Indian monsoon season from mid-July, from full moon of July to full moon of October. And in Thailand, that period is very, very rainy, and it's a good time for monks to hunker down and do a lot of study and meditation. And then the rest of the year they might be wandering or teaching. But in Canada, that's the best time for doing building work or traveling to places here and there, going canoeing. So that we sort of replace that monsoon retreat by going on a retreat January, February, March. And the idea of our monastic tradition is that we as monks learn how to practice meditation, living in solitude as well as community. And these two things are very different. Socially, obviously, could be more different. So one of the monks was on retreat for, we were all on retreat, but he was just on his own for 3 months, just came in for the meal and back. And the idea is that really you have access to books, but they're not catch 22. It's sort of more rigorous study. So the idea is not to have any distraction, and all you really have is your own mind. And it's interesting when you've got no people to talk to and no internet, nothing like that. You see what your mind produces. And it, quite often it's quite difficult. It sounds nice, little good tea, wood stove, snow outside, they feed you, right? No responsibilities, no duties, absolutely nothing. And most monks find it really restless in the beginning because they've been very, very active. And just to see the mind in a very kind of needy state, needing to do something, needing to talk, needing to have a project, whatever, and just noticing that, the restlessness of the mind. And then for most monks, they then kind of come to an accommodation of that, and their samadhi starts to get stronger, and then they start to really kind of get blissed out, and then it has to change. And the analogy I had is like after the 3 month retreat, we were like reluctant bears coming out of hibernation and discovering there are other bears in the world. And now we're again more individual. And then that's different too, just community, just living with human beings. And it might sound very nice, but human beings are very messy, aren't they? We're very messy folk with all our views and opinions and emotions and stuff that we have, and learning to accommodate that, completely different kind of practice. But the practice is the same. Still being aware and trying to deal with conflict and going beyond conflict. Because I think the project of being a grown-up is what it's like, seeing that the world actually is not going to fulfill my desires as much as I'd like it, and that conflict of not my desires not being met, I'm going to have to resolve, make conscious, articulate it, understand, go beyond it if I'm going to grow up and be a fully responsible human being. And Buddhism really works with that, but really uses that very sense of conflict that we have as human beings and tries to have us look deeply into that and see how we can come out of that as fulfilled beings, as having a kind of human flourishing in our lives. Perhaps we could just kind of I've been thinking a lot about reading about education and so on, but just kind of consider how we learn something. So let's say if I asked you to put a coat hook in the middle of that wall, I don't think Quaker people would be happy, but... And what would you have to do to put the coat hook into the wall? Well, if you just took a nail, 4-inch nail, and whacked it, you know, that ain't going to work for very long. So what you have to do, you have to find the studs, and then you have to see, well, do I want to put the coat hook on the studs, and I want it in between. So you have to get a wooden plate, run it from stud to stud, right? You have to figure out how big your screw is, how thick the metal is on your coat hook. Set it up, level it, put up a plate, screw on the hook, right? You have to do all that. But then maybe you can't find the stud. And have you ever had that? Just like these massive holes. And then you phone up your builder friend and he says, metal strips. Oh, metal strips, they do that too. Okay, now how are we going to do it now? You ask him and so on. Now what's the process of doing that? You know, what happens? Well, the idea I've been reading about, thinking about is we have to submit to the plasterboard. Right? The plasterboard has authority, not my desires. Correct? My desires want to get a coat hook in there. If I don't submit to the authority of the plasterboard, it'll become the tyranny of the plasterboard. Correct? Yeah? And so that's how we learn. We submit to the authority of reality, and then in that struggle of trying to see what reality is about by experimenting, by asking experts, by going to YouTube, we begin to have some competence. And in that competence, we begin to have a sense of fulfillment and self-worth and kind of human flourishing. And then that accomplishment isn't an egotistical thing, but it becomes a kind of avenue where we can then express ourselves more competently in that area. But we have to submit to that reality first. In the monastery, I was using just making, frying an egg. You have to submit to the authority of the egg. Right? You think of the first time you cracked an egg, mm-hmm. as a kid, there'll be eggshells all through it on the floor and so on. And you have to figure out how to break the egg, how much, you know, how hot the oil is, how long to keep it on and so on and so forth. And that to me is intelligence. You know, it's the wisdom of things rather than a factoid that I get from WikiLeaks or whatever wiki you want now. Now that can be fun. You know, I can give you a little factoid about the cost of tuna in Thailand or something like that. But that's not really intelligence. All I'm doing is just producing back some information that I received from another source. Whereas intelligence requires this kind of application of my attention on reality. And sometimes it's not so obvious. So I'm trying to get the nail in the wall, I can't get it up or whatever. And then, so like at Chithurst in England, when we renovated this old Victorian house, it wasn't plasterboard, it was 1860 the house was built. It was lath, plaster, and horsehair. It was like concrete. Yeah? Completely different. So what do? You phone up someone, a carpenter who works in heritage carpentry, or YouTube, where they have heritage carpentry or whatever. And what you also have then is you have a tradition. You have a tradition of knowledge, don't you? a tradition of people who have done building work, done carpentry, done heritage carpentry. And we learn that way too. We learn through the engagement of reality, but we also learn from those who have expertise in reality. And these are not trivial things. Like say if you got the little light on your Corolla 2005, and it says there's something wrong with the electrical system. You haven't got a clue what it's about, do you? So you go to Al's auto shop, wherever Al is, and Al's kind of covered in grease, got his head bonnet or whatever, and he comes out and he looks at it and he figures it out. He's a genius. Then he charges like a bull and you think he's really done you one. But actually, he's really worked to figure out how to fix your car. He's earned his money somewhere, unless he's a total bandit. And there's a real a kind of integrity there, isn't there? A kind of wisdom and beauty in that. Because the man really knows, he knows what he's doing. And I think all of us have had that where you think you're pretty together and then, your sewage starts to come out of your whatever, or your electrics go, and you realize I'm really dependent. Mm-hmm. I'm really dependent. And then someone comes along with this kind of expertise from a tradition of expertise and a body of knowledge, and they present the solution to you. Wow, really impressive. We have a friend staying at the monastery now. For many years he did window washing. He's wonderful. He's doing all our windows. But the way he does windows, I've never seen that. I just watch him fascinated. And so we have this possibility of skill, don't we? And I always find that absolutely delightful, the kind of human potential for doing things. And whether it's something seemingly simple like windows or something much more complex like car mechanics, I always marvel at that, that kind of human capacity. So we learn through engagement with reality, and I think that idea is that you cannot change the laws of reality just because you want them to change. You can't do that. You have to live within them, don't you? And that's the idea of Dharma. The Dharma is the truth of the way things are. And our hearts and minds and our bodies are dharmic. They're functions in nature. We don't make the laws. If you made the laws, you could do what you wanted. Tomorrow morning, wake up and be happy all day. Yeehaw! It doesn't work that way, does it? It's different. It's messy. So we engage with reality, but we have to submit to the authority of reality. But that submission isn't weak, is it? It's wise. It's waiting. It's watching and learning. And that gives us power in the world. That gives us power. But it starts with a humility. And then that power is not an arrogance. It's more like, I understand now how to live with nature. I understand its laws. To someone like some of you might have read Wendell Berry on agriculture and how his ideas of taking care of the soil and water and so on. And you could see he's got an intelligence which is very humble, very beautiful, but also gives him authority and gives him a sense of agency in the world of agriculture. So we have, as human beings, this kind of entering into reality and learning. We have tradition. So I come from, obviously, a tradition, and I look at monasticism as a kind of guild, a craft guild. That's the best way I can, not just a kind of, priesthood that somehow gives me power over you. I'll bless you and you'll get enlightened. I wish. Make a lot of money. People don't want any money. But rather it's like the craft of the heart, the craft of human living, the craft of human socializing in a particular way. It's not family. Family's another craft. But in it, in this kind of craft tradition of being a monk or this tradition of the beauty of human society, I have elders, I have teachers, and it'll be my birthday soon, so at my age there's more in the past than in the future, I think, although there's only the present. But I
I have a lot of memories.
Anyway, so just kind of, you know, thinking where I've been, and then like so the early days in Thailand, I ended up in a monastery with a lot of rural monks who came from really strong physical backgrounds where there was no luxury. Luxury just didn't exist. I remember, you know, if you saw a car once a year, it was a big deal, really. And these monks were strong men. They could work hard, and boy, could they sit. They could just sit on concrete for hours. And I was, you know, I was keen but wimpy. No real manly strength of endurance, none of that. I was determined, but then, they were like role models for me, in this guild, in this craft of trying to be a better human being, and they exhibited wonderful sense of restraint, and I could see that, oh, this is a way to do manhood. I like this way of doing manhood. It wasn't about style. Or ostentation. It was about humbly listening to the teacher and bearing with mosquitoes and being with malaria or, you know, whatever was happening, that was it. And then just seeing my own kind of preferences and restlessness and complaining. Not that other monks aren't complaining, but just that sense of learning from someone else's example. And that was it's another way we learn. We learn from authority. And the word authority is not probably very popular, but it's there. Like, I was very happy to live under my teacher. I gave him authority to instruct me. I gave him authority to admonish me. Why? Because he was a master of the craft. You know, he really knew how to be a human being. He was a happy human being. Very happy. Like Ajahn Amaro said when he went to Thailand, met Ajahn Chah, he said, here's this little man, 5'2", celibate, no money, one meal a day, sleeps on a wooden floor, has nothing, the happiest man he ever met. Yeah, I like that, right? Yeah. And we do, you know, when there is someone in a tradition that has, like, whether it's the car mechanic or the carpenter or whoever, the author, we have a sense that we can learn from this person, you know. So we submit to the authority of the person, not in an abject, foolish way, but because, you know, we love and respect authority. We love and expect experience and expertise. And when you kind of think, I'd like to learn something from this person. So we learn in that way too, don't we? And if our culture throws out tradition, you know, if everything is like, you know, kind of, you have to become a Mark Zuckerberg or whatever his name is, you know, to really make it, some super lucky guy that makes it. What about the car mechanic under the floor there? I kind of dig him more. I like his knowledge, I like his wisdom, I like what he's done with his hands and learned. And that's not very spectacular, and that's probably not much encouraged in our culture, but we meet it all the time, don't we? We meet it all the time. So we learn from people. We learn from experience, we learn from people, we learn from knowledge. Right? So like there's a tradition of knowledge that we have in whatever field we're in. So I was looking at my bird. I've got my bird feeder up, and there's a sparrow there. Even sparrows are hard to identify, aren't they? It's one of them. My first birding instructor said, "Oh, it's an LBJ, little brown joggy." That's my first bird identity. But you know, I was looking at this, and I have my Sibley's book there, Is it a tree sparrow or is it an American tree sparrow? And I look at the book and I look at the bird and then where is it? In the head, and I say, oh, it's got a line behind the eye. One is black, one is brown. Ah, it's a chipping sparrow. And I learn that way too. That's knowledge, which is abstract. It's a representation of the reality, but it engages me with reality in a very fruitful way, in a very interesting way. And that gives me more sense of presence in the world, more sense of joy in the world, more sense of interest in the world. And then my Sibley's app has a bird song on it. Mm-hmm. That one and that one. And then after a while, this is harder for me, but after a while I say, oh yeah, that's the tree sparrow. That's not the chipping sparrow. Huh? And that's beautiful. That's human knowledge, which is very beautiful. And it's about reality again, isn't it? It's like someone else's knowledge. I'm participating in that. But I have to make the effort. I have to submit to that knowledge as an expert, but then I have to apply my mind to the reality and learn about that. And that's rewarding. You know, that's very, very rewarding. So we as human beings have these different ways where we learn. And learning is such a great thing, isn't it? Such an interesting thing, makes life very interesting. So the Buddha's teaching, of course, is taking those different ways that we learn and trying to help us through this kind of craft knowledge, through this sort of handing on of wisdom from generation to generation, from monastics or lay people or whoever, and trying to encourage us to learn in the same ways. And first and foremost, you know, we learn through reality. Like sometimes, like Buddhism can seem a kind of quietism, where you know you just get with the kind of a meditative zombie state, and just get away world. I'm meditating, and that can be nice and helpful, and we all like to rest and meditation. But I think where we really learn is in the messiness of life. You know, life is like it is, and human emotions and I don't know about your emotions. My emotions are messy. They're not kind of nice and straightforward, linear piece of intellect. Feel sad, feel happy, upset. You know, this is the movement that we go through, and that's the reality. And that's the reality I have to surrender to, not in a stupid way. I say, well, what is it about? What is it about conflict in me that keeps persisting in my mind? What is it about conflict in my consciousness, in my relationship to my fellow monks or the world around me that just persists? Why can't I just be at peace with the way things are? And that question is very important. It's like the plasterboard. It's the same question. But now it's applied to something which seems much closer, but it's actually still an object. You know, just as the plasterboard is an object to my eyes and to my hammer and the screwdriver or whatever, my emotions are objects. The conflicts I feel in my heart, they're objects, aren't they? They're objects of awareness. And so that making conscious our conflicts, articulating them, not in a judgmental way, but really kind of making them come up into consciousness is what we call the kind of entering the path of Buddhism. So it's very skillful in that way because we all have conflict. It's constant. And it's coming up all the time. Because why? Well, because our desires for the objective world to be a particular way just ain't that way. And I can have all the desires I want for the plasterboard to be hardboard, but it's not going to be hardboard. Right? I can maybe want the egg to be an apple, but it's not. The egg's an egg and the apple's an apple. It's just the way it is. So when I feel what I feel, I feel what I feel. I mean, that's a tautology. But that, quite often, is the step we miss. We think that what I'm feeling and going through, the conflict shouldn't be this way. So I blame myself or blame others. And that will never work. And that's more like the infant. You know, the infant demands that the world subject itself to its will, to its desires. And if it doesn't, then it revolts. But the project of being a grown-up is articulating the conflict, isn't it? What is it about my life? And so the Buddha's kind of suggestions to us are manifold. Some are just around lifestyle. Just because a lot of conflict we have can come from a difficult lifestyle. And oftentimes, a difficult lifestyle is not our fault. It's a cultural problem. So the cultural problem we face is distraction, seems to be. You know, when I talk to folk who come to the monastery, you can see that their minds are so... Their attention is kidnapped constantly. Mm-hmm. Constantly by all kinds of methodologies now that exist, by just the volume of things one has to deal with, or the methodologies of media or whatever it might be. So our attention oftentimes is not free, it's not available. And the example I read about this, I mean, this is far out. You're in Seoul, Korea, okay? You're on a bus, this is great. And the bus is about to stop somewhere in Seoul, Korea. And as it's approaching the stop, the mechanical ventilation system pushes out a smell. Dunkin' Donuts and coffee. Really. And as it pushes out this smell into the bus, there's an advert. Dunkin' Donuts, Dunkin' Donuts, Dunkin' Donuts. And as it stops at the bus, and as you get off the bus, there's a Dunkin' Donuts shop there. And that, to me, is thievery. They're stealing the attention of people for their Dunkin' Donuts ends. And that's really kind of... to me, that's almost evil, isn't it? That's really, really creepy. And so one of the... It's a great example. So if you smell Dunkin' Donuts
in the bus.
Ottawa bus station, then make a complaint. So I don't think we're that far down the line yet, but our culture does not value attention, which is just available. You know, every space gets filled up with ads or whatever, like all over the place. So, but to really understand the wall and the wall board, you need time, right? You've got to struggle with a problem, right? You've got to figure it out. You need time to look at it. You need space. And if our attention is just preoccupied with stuff all the time, and it's not bad. I mean, you can watch YouTubes about Buddhism till the cows come home, but you won't know how to put up the board. You don't know how to meditate. Because your attention is always taken by objects. And this is, I think, the real crux of what we call renunciation. Is that renunciation is, from my sense of it, is not shaving your head and giving up watching Mickey Mouse or whatever. It's more about realizing that the objects of consciousness, and I go back to this again and again because that's my sort of primary insight, the objects of consciousness, be they seemingly internal like my emotions or the bodily sensations or my memories, the objects of consciousness, or whether it's the seeming external things like the fan or the color of the wall or the people in the room, all these are objects of awareness, that all objects are contingent. Right? They're contingent. And the conflict comes when I am not with the changing contingencies that come into my awareness. In other words, when my desire pattern doesn't fit the contingent stuff that comes at me, that conflict I need to listen to. That conflict I need to look at. And it's not about changing the stuff. You know, it's not like changing the objects. It's about seeing that no object can fulfill you. And this is the basic understanding of what we mean by renunciation and the path of enlightenment. Now, this is not dismissing the objective world. It's just saying, well, can you live in the objective world in a skillful way to give you the space of awareness to realize something profoundly more peaceful than just a contingent experience that is dependent and it just happens to happen. So we have those kinds of peaceful moments where everything comes together, right? All the all the ducks running up correctly or whatever, and oh, peaceful. But that's just circumstance. But is there a peacefulness in their hearts which is not circumstantial? And there is. Mm-hmm. And there is. And the way that is realized is not to be bamboozled by the Dunkin' Donuts, right? Or the emotions, or the body, but to see that behind all of this, this experience of being human, is actually a deep peacefulness, a deep silence. And we don't touch that because our attention is not available to that. Our attention is caught up with all these contingencies, through busyness, through distraction, whatever ways, right? And that's what we're used to doing. That's what you're used to doing. So the monk goes to the hut for his 3-month retreat. Been really, really busy. Been great, great meditation now. And the mind is just a mess. But then he sits and he watches and he doesn't go out to other objects. If he's smart, if he's stupid, he does. But if he's smart, he watches the restlessness. He watches the discontent. He watches the conflict of, I don't want this, but it's this way. And in the watching of that, because he no longer seeks a compensation, a distraction, or something else, he begins to abide as witness, as awareness, to change. And that's why we emphasize change. Because when you can notice the changing nature of the objective world, you enter into something which is not dependent on the changing nature of the world. When I notice the changing nature of my upsetness with one of the monks because they did A, B, or C, and I witness that as something that's moving, then I'm not the moving. I'm the stillness. But that can't be realized if my mind is just preoccupied all the time, preoccupied with stuff and things. So to do that, the Buddha suggests a lifestyle. And a lifestyle, and he begins, it's interesting, he begins his teaching by suggesting generosity. That's the first step. He doesn't begin by teaching emptiness. And that's a very kind of interesting thing about Buddhism is some of the highest teachings get taught first. You know, so you read some fantastic Zen master who, you know, he's been meditating for 40 years and he, you know, he does something like, I don't know, he sniffs some bamboo and he's enlightened and you think, that's it. That's how you do it. But you don't see the 40 years he's been in his hut feeling restless. You don't see all that happening. Right? So, In what the Buddha is suggesting to us, begin with generosity. Can you cultivate generosity? Why generosity? Well, generosity is the opposite of wanting this world to fit my desires, isn't it? When I'm generous, I've got space for you. I've got space for others. I can share. I've got an excess. And that's the opposite of desiring that the objective world fit my patterns of need and consumption. Right? It's not like that. And that's why generosity is such an important step in the spiritual life. Not just as a kind of cultural thing which you have to do. You know, kind of a cultural obligation, you should be generous. That's not being generous, that's just being guilt-ridden. But when you really see the wisdom, just like I see the wisdom of making sure I find the stud on that wall. I make sure I do that before I whack that nail in or put the screw in. I want to get that right. If you see the wisdom of really developing generosity in all kinds of ways that we can, you see that's the method. That's the foundation. That's the way we get to peace. And that's what you do. If I just think it's an obligation, which I must do, then I just feel guilty about feeling mean-spirited. But that's not it. Feeling mean-spirited is okay. Just don't make it a lifestyle. Right? So you feel mean-spirited, you know, oh, that's an object. It will change. It will change. So the Buddha encourages us, you know, do generosity. Do good works. Live in this world in a way where you share the goodness of your own life in language or resources or whatever you have and see what the result is. And the result is good. If I feel obliged all the time, that's egotistical. That's not the same. It's just the spontaneous learning about generosity which comes natural. And that's how you work with reality. you look at your own mind as it's operating, and you see, and I see I'm generous with this person, but I'm really actually dismissive or jealous of that one. Oh, that actually feels much more grounding, much more wholesome. That's the reality. And then, so the reality of generosity is that it's a foundation for freedom and happiness, obviously. And the reality of mean-spiritedness and so on, that it leads to more alienation and fear. That's the reality. And so it's like the plasterboard. And just knowing, yeah, if I put a nail in the middle of that plasterboard, it's going to hold nothing. It's not going to work. In the same way, if I just live in a mean-spirited, alienated way, I'm going to become more alienated. That's the reality. And I move toward generosity naturally. But the energies of mean-spiritedness might still be there. I have to be patient. I have to train. And that's the craft. It's not going to happen overnight, but I'm willing to do it because I want to learn the craft. You know, I really want to put coat hooks on walls. I really want to make an omelet. And you go through the airs. And then the Buddha suggests a sense of living in the world where we live in a kind of ethical standard where we don't harm anyone. And the way he phrases that, all manner of ways, but one nice way is that we, by not harming other beings, we liberate other beings from the fear of being harmed. It's a lovely way to look at it, isn't it? You know, by all of us not hurting each other here, we free each other from the fear that we're going to get hurt. Right? That's a lovely way to put it, which is nonviolence, ahimsa, not killing. We free each other. And we free ourselves from the remorse that comes from that. You know, like in Ontario, where I am, it's like hunt land. And I do, you know, and it's their culture. I don't play goody-good. They're good men that's their culture. They hunt and they eat the meat and so on. But I do wonder what that does to the mind. When you see an animal, you take aim and you kill it deliberately. Okay, you're eating the food, but what does that do to the mind? What does that do? It has some effect. You can't just say it has no effect. I don't know. I know my own experience of that was that I was 13 years old, and someone gave me a 22, and I was walking on the up near Barrie on the Wasaga River, and I saw it must have been a skylark way up there. You know, no way. You know, bang, and I hit it. And I ran along the river, and there it was, dead. And it was the most awful feeling. Mm-hmm. It's just a kid, right? Doing his thing, and no way. And it was such a good lesson. It was like a heavenly angel saying, "You don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. Not good. Not good." Right? So the idea of Buddhist ethics, of Buddhist morality, is like in terms of. I'll free you from the fear of losing your goods, because I'll honor your goods. I'll free you from the fear of losing your partner, because I will honor your marriage. I'll free you from the fear of being disparaged and put down behind your back, because I'll honor you with speech. I'll free you from the boredom of my intoxication by being sober. I never thought of it that way. That's a lovely way to look at it, isn't it? It's not like a... it's just, yeah, that's... And it's based on empathy. It's based on that feeling that... I don't want you to put me down behind my back. If I hear about that, I'm not going to feel very good. I'm not going to trust you. You know, I don't like that feeling, so you don't like that feeling. So why should I do it to you if I don't like it to me? And it's a really beautiful way. And all these, like, generosity in this way of looking at the moral life is a way of going away from alienation. And so there's a kind of human flourishing in that, a kind of human beauty in our societal ways that we live together. And that's the basis for attention being available. Right? Because when we have a sense of connection and human goodness in those that we relate with, Your attention is now no longer caught up with things. It's like available. You're open. Attention is available. And only after those kinds of considerations of lifestyle and living a meaningful life does the Buddha start to introduce, you know, the ideas of meditation and the philosophy of the phenomenology of Buddhism. So Buddhism is divided into kind of two ways of teaching. One is the kind of social contract we live in, and the best way to do that, which is a basis for enlightenment. And then it looks at the human mind, as human experience, as phenomenon. And that's a completely different way of looking at it. So there's the phenomenon, like there's the cultural, social situation of me sitting here and talking to you, right? And we can agree upon that. But each of you is experiencing the phenomena of this room in different ways. You feel hot, you feel too hot, you're interested in what I say, you want to go to the toilet, you're not so interested in what I want to say, da 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 da. So there's the phenomenon of the experience, right? Arising and ceasing. And that phenomenon is part body, part emotion, part thought, part memory, and so on, and it's a flow. And the interesting thing about the flow, this flow cannot take place if you're not aware. And you're always aware. You may not think you're aware, but consciousness is always there. Have you ever been absent? Even in your daydreams, you are not absent. You're always present. Even when you run into a lamppost because you didn't see it, you were still present because you were still in those thought patterns. Consciousness is always here and now. And this is the thing that when we start to see the phenomena of our emotions and our life as objects that come and go, we begin to intuit that behind it, awareness is unshakable. And the more you intuit that, the less you need from the objective world. The less you need from the objective world. Because you find that that's your real home. That's really where you find peace. And the beauty of that is then as you find your refuge there, in your heart, in that sense of presence, then the movement of the phenomenon of the world, you respond to that in an appropriate way where you don't hold on to it. You do what you have to do, but it doesn't ricochet in your mind for 6 days. Bounce around in your noggin, you know, like that argument you had that just goes on for 6 days. Bang, bang, bang in your head. And you act appropriately, but you come back to the refuge of awareness. And that refuge is very subtle. It's not like awareness of this moment is not exciting. It's not frightening. It's not hot. I feel hot, right? I don't know. You feel hot? Okay, I feel hot. Is awareness hot? No. Awareness knows hot. Right? You go outside, you feel cold. Check it out. Go outside and see if awareness felt cold. It won't feel cold, will it? Body will feel cold, perception will be cold, and it'll tell you put your coat on. So it's there for a reason. But awareness won't feel cold, will it? Right? I had some coffee at Starbucks, so I'm feeling wired. That's why I won't stop talking. And I might stay up all night and regret it tomorrow morning. But awareness isn't wired. It knows wired. And my desire mind says, you idiot. You're too old for this. But it's not. Awareness isn't wired. It knows wired. It knows cold. And that is so, so beautiful, because that awareness doesn't depend on your education system, on your gender, on your age, whatever. It's a universal. It's where we all, you know, where we all belong, really. And that's our real home. So I would encourage you in the, you know, whatever way your life is moving and developing, to really use the kind of very real conflicts you have to see how can you be with conflict in a way which is compassionate and moral, and yet not take refuge in conflict. not let it rule you, and yet understand yourself through conflict. Because that's a great source of freedom, isn't it? A great source of beauty. All right? I'll leave that for your reflection.
Handamayang dhammakataya sadhu karam tadamase
sadhu sadhu.